Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Second day in a row, breaking down a 1-0 game. This time the Toronto Blue Jays win 1-0. Kevin Gausman, excellent. Over 7 innings, as you'd have to be to get a win when you only get one run of support, which has kind of been the story of Kevin Gausman's season. He is, I believe, third to last among qualified starters in average runs of support, which sucks. That's got to really suck if you're Kevin Gausman. It's got to be tough to go up on the bump every time out and know you have to basically be perfect to come away with a win. But he did it. Not perfect. 4 hits, but no walks, no earned runs, 6 strikeouts over 7. Pretty pitch efficient too. Only threw 90 pitches. Probably could have justified throwing him out there for an eighth, given the extra rest the guys have built in. But the bullpen's in decent shape right now, so they turn it over there. And some interesting deployment of the bullpen in the eighth and the ninth, really going without Jordan Romano, the team's closer, available right now. He's on the IL. John Schneider goes purely matchup based. No one has slotted into that role as a traditional closer type. Now, Jordan Hicks comes up with the save, but he comes up with the save after Eric Swanson is trusted with the bottom of the order in the eighth. Tim Mayza comes in for the ninth versus lefty, and a switch hitter in Jose Ramirez, who hits worse from the right side. He gets two of those batters out, turns to the right-handed part of the lineup, Oscar Gonzalez, so they go to Jordan Hicks for one out. Jays get out of it. Now, didn't need to be that tight. Stop me if you heard this before. Jays had plenty of opportunities to do more damage than the one run they put up. The one run they did put up was a first-inning home run from George Springer that came at the end of a tremendous 13-pitch plate appearance. That was the 6th fastball he saw. He fought off 3 or 4 sliders and sweepers right on the edge with 2 strikes to defend and keep the plate appearance going longer. Eventually finds a fastball to hit, drives it for a home run. Things went downhill in a big way for the Jays offense. From there, it was yet another night where they couldn't get things going once guys were on base. They had a couple of really good opportunities in the second inning. Schneider and Kirk drew walks, so they have runners on first and second with only one out. Get nothing out of it. 5th inning, Springer and Whit Merrifield back-to-back with singles. So you've got 2 on and only 1 out again. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. takes a first pitch fastball middle, and grounds into a double play with it. In the 7th inning, you get a runner on base. Paul DeJong strikes out, and hopefully your children weren't lip reading too closely with Paul DeJong's reaction there. Dalton Varsho also strikes out, and then a nice catch from Stephen Kwan ends the threat there. In the 8th, you're looking at a bases loaded, nobody out situation. Danny Jansen flies out. Davis Schneider gets a curveball hung over the plate and grounds into a double play. The 10th time this year, the Jays have grounded into a double play with the bases loaded. That's only 3rd overall. They are 2nd in overall ground into double plays on the season in general. They have 98 of them. If you ever sort by double play stats, no matter the split or filter you put on, the Miami Marlins will lead the league by such a dramatic margin. It's almost unfathomable. They have about 30% more double plays grounded into than the Blue Jays, who are in 2nd place. Anyway, the George Springer home run stands as the deciding factor through 3 games in this series. Now, the Jays have taken 2 of 3. They lead 4-2 in score on aggregate. It's been incredibly low scoring. We'll see if that continues today as Alek Manoah takes on Noah Syndergaard at 1 p.m. We'll tee that one up for you throughout the show here. But we've got some Jose Bautista talk today. John Gibbons is going to join us around 11:30. We've got some prospect talk today. Jeff Ponce, who is of Baseball America and was recently down at the Jays Dunedin Complex, is going to join us at 11, give us some insight into who looked good down at the Complex League, what we're looking for when we look at Complex League or even low A box scores. We'll talk the debut of first round pick Arjun Amala, in addition to a number of other prospects in the system, including high risers like Alan Roden and Connor Cook, who's now up at AAA. Before we do any of that, though, we're going to talk about last night's game, and we're going to do some. I promised it last week. We didn't have time with this guest, but Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score joins us now for a little. We'll talk about last night first, but we're going to get to some Jose Bautista trivia. Jonah, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, buddy. How are you?
I am good. Yesterday was your birthday, so I texted you, but happy belated birthday. The crowd is applying here in the radio studio.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, pal.
Okay, so Jays win 1-0 yesterday. Oh, by the way, sorry. We'll be taking some texts throughout the show as well, so you can send those into 590-590. Questions about the current state, how they manage the 3 days off in 8 days ahead, favorite Jose Bautista memories, whatever you got, 590-590. So, Jonah Birenbaum of The Score. The Jays win 1-0 yesterday, up 4-2 on aggregate over 3 games against the Guardians. This is Guardians baseball. I guess some people might say grinding these greasy ones out is a form of playoff baseball. I tend not to agree when those come against bad teams. How are you feeling about taking 2 of 3 with almost nothing from the bats?
I mean, you know, wins are wins. And at this point, you know, you can't be discounting any victories because there is no margin for error in the American League playoff race. Having said that, the Blue Jays have now been limited to 4 runs or fewer in 6 of their 9 games without Bo Bichette. You know, we spoke about this last week, but so far the offense really hasn't picked it up in his absence. And, you know, certainly going up against a couple of Guardians pitchers who are rather inexperienced, you would have hoped that the Blue Jays could cobble together a little bit more offense. But frankly, I mean, last night was kind of the quintessential Blue Jays win in 2023. You ride a very strong effort from a starting pitcher. You cobble together barely enough offense while utterly failing to convert with runners in scoring position. And then the bullpen comes in and locks it down. That has been the recipe for countless victories this season. And that has mostly continued against Cleveland. I mean, obviously, if they don't escape with a victory today, the series against a really weak team will feel like something of a disappointment because you don't want to split against a team that, frankly, you know, is one of the worst offensively in all of baseball and is down one of its best hitters in Josh Naylor. But, you know, in today's battle of, you know, former one-time future Blue Jays aces, Manoah versus Syndergaard, you hope that Manoah can ride the momentum that he generated in his previous outing against the Boston Red Sox, carry that into a very favorable matchup today, and the offense can find a way to cobble together, and this is a novel idea, multiple runs.
Multiple runs is novel. We'll see if they can get that going. Syndergaard, of course, not the guy that he was shortly after the Blue Jays traded him when he was one of the better and more electric pitchers in baseball. Alek Manoah, good challenge today, even though this lineup is not particularly good. It's a lineup that can stack as many as 8 left-handed hitters or switch hitters if they so choose. We know Alek Manoah struggled a little bit with the platoon stuff, although against the Red Sox on the weekend, that wasn't quite as big an issue. Jonah, a little bit more from last night's game before we pivot to Jose Bautista stuff. You mentioned the bullpen coming in and locking it down. Obviously, Kevin Gausman gives them 7 really good innings. With Jordan Romano out, John Schneider opts to not elevate someone as the closer in that spot. He goes to Eric Swanson, who has been the second highest leverage guy all year because he likes him against that bottom of the order that has some lefties and maybe don't do well against the splitter. He turns it to Tim Meza for a top of the order that is lefty heavy, turns Jose Ramirez around to his weaker side, and then goes to Jordan Hicks for the one out save to avoid that lefty righty platoon matchup. I mean, the results speak for themselves last night. Obviously, you're doing what you can with Jordan Romano down, but I wonder, Jonah, is this something, that deployment of the back end of a bullpen that is now a little deeper than it was earlier in the year, would you like to see that kind of usage continue even when Jordan Romano's back? Or would you like to see Romano, hey, that's the closer's role, get him back in there. There's something to be said for role stability.
I definitely think that Jordan Romano has done nothing to deserve to not have the 9th inning entrusted to him. But certainly, you know, prior to the 9th inning, this is exactly the kind of bullpen deployment that you love to see. Like, there's no reason, given the depth that they have now, not to be optimizing matchups. And, you know, they have the weapons to do that. They have a diversity of looks now. You know, you added a huge velocity right-hander who gets not only a lot of swing and miss, but a lot of ground balls in Jordan Hicks. You have righties who are really effective against lefties because of splitters. You have Tim Meza, who is just murder on left-handed bat. So they have a multiplicity of weapons, sort of a look for every different kind of offensive profile, regardless of handedness. There's no reason not to keep, you know, rolling your bullpen like this. And especially, like I said, with the depth now, you know, you can push guys a little bit more because theoretically there's more organic opportunities for rest because they don't have to rely on the same 2 or 3 guys anytime there's a leverage spot. So, you know, when Romano comes back, I do think that he deserves to have the ninth inning be his responsibility. And there's no need to get overly cute with it because he is one of the best closers in all of Major League Baseball, even though, you know, some would argue that his season hasn't been quite as confidence inspiring as, say, last year's was. But yeah, for now, you know, I do think that the ninth inning is his, but, you know, certainly, you know, seventh, eighth, I think that John Schneider would be remiss not to continue being as creative and as aggressive in matchup optimization as he's been in Romano's absence.
Yeah, enjoy it. And you know, the Mesa usage, obviously Mesa has earned enough trust to face some righties sometimes and not worry about that as much. But one run game against a righty with a pretty significant platoon advantage there, I'm in favor of it. On the hitting side, Jonah, I don't want to get too excited about a little stretch here that's been honestly really like BABIP fortunate for George Springer. He's had a couple. Now, look, he was probably owed more than a couple dropping in after the stretch that he was on there. But, you know, over his last six, he's got 12 hits, four of those for extra bases. And last night's 13 pitch at bat before that home run, Jonah, when you see a guy work one like that, foul off as many defensive two strikes as that and find his pitch to drive, numbers aside and 12 hits in six games aside, does seeing an at-bat like that, a battle like that, inspire a little bit of confidence in you that George Springer is starting to see things and feel things a little bit better?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're working in a bat that deep, not only are you recognizing pitches out of the hand, but, you know, you're getting good swings off. You're really battling. And I think for that abysmal stretch from, you know, sort of mid-July through early August, we weren't seeing George battle. He was immediately, you know, falling behind in counts, and therefore he was much more vulnerable to spinning stuff off the plate. He was just not generating any leverage in his plate appearances, and that was putting him in really difficult spots. For the last week or so, or better part of a week, he's been getting ahead in counts. He's been driving his pitch when he gets it. He's been fouling off pitchers' pitches. And it just speaks to the fact that I think he is doing a better job of recognizing pitches out of the hand, of making in-at-bat adjustments, and critically of driving his pitch when he gets it. I think that's also been one of the major issues for him and for this team more broadly this year, is that, you know, even when they do find themselves in favorable counts and they get their pitches, they just don't square them up. But in the case of Springer, lately he's been doing that more, and it's a testament to the fact that he's just having much higher quality plate appearances and seeing the ball significantly better.
And how does that transfer over to Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? Because I know you've been pretty frustrated with him. A couple of line drives yesterday, but a really tough miss, fastball middle in a big situation. First pitch ground into a double play. I mean, we don't need to belabor the Vlad thing, I guess, every time you come on, but it does feel like every time we've scheduled you, it's coming off a particularly rough Vlad day. I mean, let's even lower the bar here a little bit. What does Vlad need to do to get back to where you're just comfortable with the level that he's at, instead of, you know, it's whether it's pressing or reaching or just a misfortune right now, there's not a lot adding up about what Vlad's doing at the plate.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the very least, what he needs to do is start punishing mistakes again, right? You can say, you know, that he needs to be more selective in the zone, or he needs to chase less, or he needs to find himself with count leverage more frequently. But I think the critical thing, and this was best exemplified last night, is that even when he gets his pitch, even when he gets a cookie, he's not necessarily doing damage. Like last time that we chatted, I said, well, he needs to be more selective in the zone. And even if he's getting strikes early in counts, if they aren't strikes that he can drive, he should let him fly and wait to get a pitch that he can really barrel up. Well, last night, in a run-producing opportunity, he gets a cookie, that he can barrel up, and he rolls over and grounds into a double play. So, you know, if Vlad isn't punishing mistakes and he's not being more selective, then, you know, that's not a profile that's going to lead to elite offensive production. So at the very least, you need to see him start punishing pitches in the middle of the zone, fastballs in the middle of the zone, because if he's not doing that, then, you know, it's really easy, you know, to sort of, you know, challenge him, frankly, because those are the pitches that certainly, you know, average big leaguers should be doing damage on, and certainly that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. should be turning around and putting in the seats.
And tough to see right now, especially when the Jays' offense is struggling as it is. Bo Bichette isn't in there. A day where Brandon Belt's not in the lineup to help set it up for Vlad. That was a mistake pitch, but pitchers are not afraid of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. right now, even with no, I mean, we don't truly believe in lineup protection at the big macro level, but at the micro at bat level it exists, and we're just not seeing any fear there. You know who was feared a lot and like led the league in intentional walks a lot at one point, Jonah, is Jose Bautista. So let's turn the page here. We will talk more about last night's game. We will set up the 1 p.m. outing between Alec Manoah and Noah Syndergaard later in the show. Also, a small note from our pal Caitlin McGrath at The Athletic. Hyunjin Ryu starting Sunday. He is what was a TBD is now Hyunjin Ryu's spot on the probable pitcher. So it'll be Berríos, Bassett, and Ryu against Assad, Steele, and Taillon. The Cubs juggling things up there as they move Drew Smyly, originally scheduled as Saturday's pitcher, to the bullpen. I say Saturday's pitcher because we had mentioned that. Because it's Jose Bautista level of excellence day. He will be honored up at Rogers Center. Jonah, before we get into some Jose Bautista trivia here, look, you and I were around each other for basically all of those 2015 and 2016 runs. You were, you know, starting, not starting out, but earlier in your career at Baseball Prospectus, and then The Score. How much does Jose Bautista going to the level of excellence mean to you as a longtime Blue Jays fan and someone who's covered this team for a long time?
It's incredibly significant. I think it's undeniable that this team has not had a more significant player since 1993. Not only was he the heart and soul and the emotional center of the best Blue Jays team since Joe Carter's trip around the bases, but he was the linchpin of the organization for so many years prior, and really the catalyst that made possible all of the wonderful memories that Blue Jays fans forged in 2015 and 2016. Remember, that era was supposed to be devoid of memories. In 2010, when the Blue Jays traded away Roy Halladay, the organization was seemingly headed for an extended reset, rebuild, whatever word you want to use. The organization, which had just come under Alex Anthopoulos, was supposed to be building for the future. And then Jose Bautista decided to hit 54 home runs in 2010. And that singular development truly changed the course of franchise history. Without Bautista transforming into one of the most dangerous hitters in the league, they don't broker that mega deal with the Marlins in 2013. They don't go out and acquire R.A. Dickey. They don't sign Russell Martin ahead of 2015. They don't trade for Josh Donaldson. So 2015-2016 doesn't happen without Jose Bautista becoming Jose Bautista. He was the straw that stirred the proverbial drink, and he was just so good. He was endlessly entertaining, deliciously brazen, unafraid to speak his mind to umpires, to the media, to flex on opponents. He was the consummate superstar, and it was only fitting that it was Bautista who authored the signature moment of the last two-plus decades of Blue Jays baseball, because, as I mentioned off the top, this team hasn't had a more significant player since they were last World Series champions.
Well said, Jonah, and we'll get to some of the 2015-2016 stuff, but if we're going to do a little Jose Bautista trivia here, we're going to start back at the beginning and warm up a little bit, all right?
Let's do it.
Okay, so Jays acquire Jose Bautista in 2008 for a player to be named later. We find out shortly after that player to be named later is
Robinson Diaz.
There you go. All right, we're cooking here. Okay, we're starting light. We're going to ramp up the difficulty as we go a little bit here. Okay, so on September 5th, 2009, this is his first full season with the Blue Jays. We're talking September, and he's sitting there with just 3 home runs on his tally. His OPS at that point, Jonah, was over or under 670.
I think his OBP was quite low. I'm going to take the under.
It was 662. You're 2 for 2.
Whew.
Yeah, that's, I mean, honestly, you hear that a guy like Jose Bautista only had 3 home runs over the first 5 months of the season. I might have thought even lower than 662.
Then he hit, what, 27 in the month of September?
Well, this is your next trivia question. How many did he hit from that point on? He got 111 plate appearances from September 6th on. He had 3 home runs before that point. How many did he hit down the stretch?
Oh, it was just outrageous. It was double digits. I want to say 11.
It was 10.
Oh!
And he had 6 in the final 8 games of the season.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Unbelievable heater. I talked to Travis Snyder about it yesterday, and just like the way that, you know, hearing Travis talk about the way the room realized something had clicked with an adjustment there. Yeah, he hit 10 home runs in not even a full month. Okay, so that's 2008. That's 2009, Jonah. 2010 rolls around. He hits a franchise record 54 home runs. Before Jose Bautista did that, who was first all time on the Blue Jays leaderboard?
Single season home runs?
Yes.
I want to say, it's either Bell or Delgado. I'm going to go with Carlos Delgado.
Ooh, George Bell with 47. So here's a question. That George Bell is no longer second on the home run, single season home run leaderboard. Who is?
Who is second on, who hit more than?
More than 40.
Oh, well, of course, Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
There you go. He hit 48 not that long ago. Okay, so he's going for, Jose Bautista is going for the franchise record. He's sitting on 47. He's tied it. The franchise record breaking number 48 home run came at which ballpark?
I want to say it came in Minnesota.
No, division rival. I'll give you Joke Stadium. That doesn't really narrow it down in the American League East, though.
Joke Stadium for a right-handed hitter at Boston.
Yeah, it was. It was September 17th at Fenway against Michael Bowden.
Right.
Bowden Francis, of course. Okay, so number 50 then. He becomes the first, a couple days later, he becomes the first Blue Jay to hit 50. It is the lone run. Hey, how fitting is this? The lone run in a 1-0 victory. It comes at home. Who do you hit that one off of?
The king, Felix Hernandez.
There you go. There you go. Okay, so Felix Hernandez, imagine you're Felix and you, I mean, hey, it's got to be what Gausman feels like pretty much every time out right now, right?
I mean, his entire career in Seattle was essentially a Gausman impersonation.
Okay, so Batista's broken the record. He's hit 50. He's just pouring on gravy at this point. Number 53 and 54, the last two, come in a 6-homer game. The Jays beat the Twins 13-2. Batista has 2 of the 6. Who have the other 4?
Oh, my goodness. Gosh.
I have mentioned one of them already. He was on the show this week.
Oh, my gosh. Did Edwin Encarnacion have one?
He had 2.
He had 2?
Yeah.
2011. Did Adam Lind have one?
He did not.
Did... Ooh. Lyle Overbay?
He did not. Okay, I'm going to give you a hint. The one that was on the show earlier this week was Travis Snyder. I had mentioned his name. The other was a portly catcher from a family of catchers.
Benji Molina. Jose Molina.
There you go. 2 homers for Jose, 2 homers for Edwin, 1 for Travis Snyder, 1 for Jose Molina. Quite a game there. Okay, so that's 2010. 54 home runs. 2011 rolls around. Jose Bautista only hits 43 home runs. He still leads the league. He also he leads the league with a 608 slugging, a 1.056 OPS. It's ridiculous. He leads the league in walks with 132. How many of those walks were intentional?
Over 29.
Under, 29? Okay. The answer is 24. So that's pretty close. Ugh. That's pretty close.
Not a bad guess.
No, it's a good guess. It's a good guess. Okay, so there is only one Blue Jay in history who has a season with an OPS plus. So OPS plus, for anyone who doesn't know, takes a player's on-base plus slugging and adjusts for the era and some other factors so that we can more cleanly compare across seasons. Hey, the offense in 92-93 was way higher than it was in 2011. So how do we compare apples to apples here? Jose Bautista's in 2011 was 182. Only one Blue Jay has ever had an OPS plus higher than that. Who was it?
That's enormous. I feel like it was someone from WAMCO as opposed to a more recent player.
A WAMCO.
Okay. I want to say it was John Olerud.
John Olerud in 1993 had a 186 OPS plus. He led the league in batting average, OBP, OPS, OPS plus, doubles, and intentional walks.
Wow.
Monster season for John Olerud. Jose Bautista, so 2010, he hits 54 home runs. 2011, he hits 43 and leads the league in most statistical categories. Doesn't win the American League MVP in either of those years. Do you remember who did?
I believe Justin Verlander won in 2011.
He did?
And 2010.
Yep.
Was...
Great comeback story, big home run derby moment.
Josh Hamilton.
Josh Hamilton, it is. He only, quote unquote, hit 32 home runs, but he also hit 359 that year.
I couldn't remember if it was Hamilton or Justin Morneau. Mm. So your hint definitely helped.
Okay, good. Okay, so 2012 to 14, these are the years that Alex Anthopoulos is trying to go in, but the Jays can't manage to put it together. Jose Bautista is absolutely pathetic over these 3 years. His OPS was just over or just under 900?
Under.
Just under, 893.
Wow.
Over those three seasons. Those were his
rough stretch.
Yeah, those were his down years, 893. Okay, last one on 2014 before we get to the playoff eras. Finish this quote. Who are you and?
Why are you talking to me?
There you go. Yeah. That's a little inside baseball one for anyone who gets that. Who are you and why are you talking to me from Jose Bautista?
Well crafted.
Okay, 2015-2016. We'll ratchet back the difficulty here before we ramp it back up.
Okay.
Jose Bautista hits the bat flip home run. Who do you hit it off of?
Sam Dyson.
Of course. Blue Jays legend.
The 1-1 from Dyson.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, this is a true or false question. While watching that game, we invited the delivery guy to come in and watch some of the game with us.
That is very true, and I seem to recall like just forcing him to down a beer before he departed.
Yeah, I'm not going to expose him on that front, but yeah, may have invited the delivery guy in because the game was that big, and it was it was building community to that degree. Okay, so he also homered in twice in the Game 6 loss to the Kansas City Royals. He hits a 2-run shot in the 8th inning to tie that game. Bottom of the 8th, this relief pitcher allows the losing runs. Run, rather, singular.
Ryan Madsen.
No. This is on the Jays side. Allows the losing run in the bottom of that.
Oh, pardon me. It was Madsen who gave up that bomb, but I want to say it was Roberto Osuna.
It was Roberto Osuna. The weird runner on first scores from a single play, Lorenzo Cain. Tough way to go. Another tough way to go in that game. The Ben Revere strike call. Who was the home plate umpire?
I believe it was Jeff Nelson.
What a pull. Good job. Good job.
He haunts my dreams for the better part of the last decade.
All right. So 2016, the wild card game against Baltimore. Zach Britton is still sitting. I don't know how they've managed to do the renovations around Zach Britton, who's still sitting out there. Edwin hits that home run to walk the game off. But earlier in that game, Jose Bautista had a really big home run as well. Who did he hit that one off of? Baltimore Orioles starter in this game.
Chris Tillman.
Good pull. Someone tried to convince me recently it was Kevin Gausman. I was like, no, there's no way. I never would have been able to stomach Kevin Gausman being a Blue Jay if he'd started that particular game.
Chris, I don't think he could have stomached it.
Yeah, I don't know that he could have either. That's what a game that was. Yeah. Were you at that one, Jonah?
I was. As a matter of fact, I was piggybacking with a good friend of mine. So we were not seated beside one another, but we were seated essentially on top of one another in adjoining rows. As soon as that inning started against and you saw Ubaldo Jimenez coming in, you felt that the Blue Jays probably had a pretty good chance. And then, Edwin made history.
Yeah, we love a wild card game to come down to a pitching duel between Ubaldo Jimenez and Francisco Liriano. Really how every team draws it up heading into the postseason. By the way, here are the other pitchers that the Orioles pitched in that game rather than go to Zach Britton, one of the best closers in baseball. Chris Tillman, Michael Gibbons, Donnie Hart, Brad Brach, Darren O'Day, Brian Dunsing, and Ubaldo Jimenez. Zach Britton, just chilling. Just
hanging out,
chilling in the bullpen. He of the 0.54 ERA that season, unused.
He received Cy Young votes that year, but that's not a guy you want pitching in potentially your last game of the season. You need to save him for a save situation that may not arise.
He allowed 4 earned runs in 67 innings that season. And just didn't use him. Damn. If the Orioles weren't headed where they were headed, Edwin certainly helped put them there. Okay, so career-wise now, let's take a look. Jose Bautista's heading to that level of excellence. Obviously, that means beyond just a few big moments here and there, he has also had a large impact on this franchise career-wise. It's not just peak, it's longevity. We mentioned he was acquired in 2008. He was there through 2015 and 2016. He spent an awful lot of time with this team. He stuck around until what, end of 2017? So he is, by a hair, number one on the all-time Blue Jays leaderboard in position player wins above replacement. That is the top of the leaderboard, even though they calculate it differently, is the same 1, 2, 3 on both Baseball Reference and Fangraphs. Jose Bautista is at the top. Who are 2 and 3?
I believe 2, and it's another guy who was with the franchise for an exceedingly long time. I believe 2 is Tony Fernandez.
Yes.
And I believe 3 is Carlos Delgado.
You got it. 1, 2, 3. Jose Bautista narrowly edging out Fernandez and Delgado, and then there's a pretty big gap before you get to the rest, and then you get into, well, just how good was Jesse Barfield's arm, and how do we incorporate that into WAR? Because defensive WAR, he's right up there with Tony Fernandez. Bautista, despite being first in position player WAR, is only fourth in career OPS. Now, he obviously had the 2008 and 5 months of the 2009 season where he wasn't quite Jose Bautista yet. You know, there are guys who only played their peak with Toronto, of course, and Bautista, you know, kind of played into his decline years. So he's only fourth in OPS. Who's higher? You just mentioned one of them on the WAR leaderboards.
So one is Carlos Delgado.
Yep.
And I believe 2 and 3, not necessarily in this order, but I believe 2 and 3 are Fred McGriff and Josh Donaldson.
They are in the opposite order. Josh Donaldson's 2. Fred McGriff is 3. Here's just because I came. This is a purely a longevity stat. Jose Bautista is also second in franchise history in grounding into a double play. Who is first? And no, it's not Vlad yet.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
it's not. This is a longevity stat, though.
You really anticipated that joke.
Yeah.
Longevity stat. I'm trying to think which era.
Black jersey era outfielder for a very long time.
Vernon Wells?
Yeah. There you go. He passed the torch. They unloaded Vernon Wells, so they had the money to extend Jose Bautista, is your connection there beyond the ground in a double play. Bautista also, despite starting out as an infielder who bounced around the diamond a bunch, is second all-time in franchise outfield assists. The three names around him, I just said number one, is obviously Barfield. 3 and 4 were the other members of Barfield's outfield. Who were they?
One has got to be Lloyd Mosby.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is George Bell.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. One of the best all around outfields ever constructed. Like, all of those guys are in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame and have terrific career stats and things like that. But yeah, being 1, 3, 4 in outfield assists. Why? I know we didn't have analytics yet, but how was there not a book out on Don't Run on the Toronto Blue Jays outfield in that era? Okay. Here, last two on the Bautista trivia. First one is a little immaculate grid kind of question for you. Jose Bautista, not sure everyone realizes this. Some people surely do, but he bounced around a lot before getting to the Toronto Blue Jays and then also after leaving the Toronto Blue Jays. He is an 8-team immaculate grid guy. Can you name all 8?
Okay. We got the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yes.
We have the Baltimore Orioles.
Yes.
We have the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yep.
The Atlanta Braves.
Yep.
The New York Mets.
Yep.
The Philadelphia Phillies. The Kansas City Royals.
Ooh, one more.
And the Tampa Bay Devil Rays.
He played 15 games for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Or 12 games, rather. He got 15 plate appearances. He went 2 for 12 with 3 walks in a 2004 season where he played for Baltimore, Tampa, Kansas City, and Pittsburgh.
Wow.
A four team season is a grid catnip for sure. Okay, last one. In 2018, a Canadian scientist named a species of what animal after Jose Bautista?
Oh man, how about
it's a bug?
It's a bug.
Bug.
I don't know. I don't want to guess incorrectly and say a species that would be insulting. How about, I don't know, a millipede?
A beetle.
A beetle?
Yes. Entomologist Bob Anderson in 2018, a scientist at the Canadian Museum of Nature, they discovered a new species of beetle, or weevil, if you prefer, and he named it Cicadaris batistae.
And during his Blank career, we always called him the fifth Beatle. It was John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Jose.
Yeah, certainly. That was the Blue Jays version of Whamco for sure. Okay, so Jose Bautista going into the level of excellence down at the park this weekend. We've heard from a couple of teammates and former managers and things like that who will be down there. Travis Snyder, Ricky Romero, John Gibbons, who's on the show a little later today. Surely Edwin will be there since he's always around. How much are you looking forward to Saturday? Are you going to be down there?
I will be down there. I'm sure I will be misty-eyed because it'll bring back just an absolute trove of wonderful memories. You know, that was a highly significant era in Blue Jays history broadly. Certainly for me specifically, I had never seen in my lifetime, well, in my conscious lifetime, a Blue Jays team go to the playoffs. And certainly, you know, the role that Jose played, not only in facilitating that glow up in 2015, 2016, but then what he accomplished during those seasons and during those postseasons, you know, he's obviously incredibly meaningful to me personally. So, yeah, I can't wait. I'm really looking forward. I'm sure that I'll shed a tear when I see him strut out to the pitcher's mound. Frankly, I'd rather see a ceremonial hose from right field to third base. I think that would be fitting, but I don't know if I don't know what condition his arm is in, yeah, no, it's going to be a wonderful weekend, and I'm sure that Blue Jays fans will really, really relish it, and I hope Jose does as well.
I was thinking, you know, after he's done speaking, he flips the mic, obviously. Now, Mike, you know, dynamics-wise is not going to fly like a bat flies, but I'm sure we'll get something like that. Bautista, ever the showman. Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score, thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy. Great job on the trivia. I hope it wasn't too long a trivia, but I felt like it was a fun way to remember Jose Bautista. And yeah, man, enjoy the heck out of Saturday. Hopefully this year's team is going to give us some playoff action that we can remember, and invite a delivery guy in for a beverage as well.
Absolutely. You know, enjoy the weekend yourself, my man. Thanks so much for having me on.
Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score, a good pal of mine who I experienced most of that 2015-2016 run with. We were both, 2015 run, we were both working at The Score at the time. 2016 run, I was kind of doing my own thing independently, but down at a lot of those games, trying to work in some summer concerts around them. Of course, not always watching at the park, but yeah, man, the Jose Bautista stuff brings back some fun games. Those 2 years were incredible. It really does hammer home, I think, too. Not that this isn't obvious. It's obvious that playoff baseball would be a lot of fun, but it really does hammer home just how cool a semi-long run. Like, those teams didn't go to the World Series, but we all remember those series pretty dramatically. We do not really remember the two-game sweep at the hands of the Seattle Mariners or the Tampa Bay Rays. So, you know, I don't think the players on this version of the team need any sort of reminder of that, but the Jose Bautista day will, I think, really hammer home how special you become to a city and a fan base and the culture around a sport if you can make a bit of a run. So hopefully there is some of that ahead. There is a game ahead today at 1 p.m. We've got a lineup. We'll take a break first. We'll take you through the lineup, some of the pitching matchups. And then in the second half of the show at 11 o'clock, Jeff Ponce is going to join us from Baseball America. He was down at the Blue Jays complex in Dunedin earlier this week and over the weekend. So he got a firsthand look at a lot of the players early in the Blue Jays minor league system, including some recent draft picks. And then at 11:30, we'll talk to Gibby. John Gibbons joins us, but we'll take you through the lineups, some of your questions to 590-590, and look at the pitching matchups. Nexus. Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Covering the Raptors in depth like no one else. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. I am looking at a TV monitor that has a feed from down in Cleveland. It is clear skies at Progressive. It's going to be a beautiful one for baseball. That game's at 1 o'clock. We will, of course, have it for you here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Show Ali and Ben Shulmanov, Jays Talk for you for an hour before the game, 12 to 1, as well as Jays Talk after the game. Blair and Barker coming to you in their normal time slot, 5 to 7, because this game should be wrapped up nice and tidy by then. The way the first three games here went, this game will probably be done by like 3 o'clock because it'll be 1-0 again. Couple of news items before we get into the lineups. The biggest one, Chris Bassitt has released a statement on the red jerseys. On Instagram, he posts a photo of himself in the Reds, taken by our pal Keyshawn Mistry. By the way, Keyshawn does awesome work. Him and Ali Khan around the Blue Jays, just an unbelievable, and Jelani Morgan, an unbelievable wealth of cool photos and videos and moment capturing around this Blue Jays team. So shout out to Keyshawn and the rest of that group. But Chris Bassitt posts this photo of himself in red, and he says, I loved, past tense, the Reds. Didn't realize how many people hate them. I now hate them, but I hate that I love them. Canada Day only being the hashtag from Chris Bassitt. He just has to hope that whenever we get a Blue Jays City Connect jersey, that it is not a red one. So Chris Bassitt now firmly on your side in disliking the red jerseys. A couple other items that came out yesterday from John Schneider's media availability. You knew by then that Kevin Kiermaier hit the IL. Nathan Lucas is up. Nathan Lucas got in the game last night as a defensive replacement. Jordan Romano was throwing a bullpen session yesterday in Toronto. We'll see how he responded to that, and the team will make a determination on whether or not he needs a rehab assignment before returning. The big one from yesterday, Chad Green. We mentioned yesterday that in a Tuesday game, his sixth rehab appearance, he had been hit in the head by a Tyler Heineman throw down to second base. Chad Green has been placed on the 7-day concussion IL. Obviously, the foremost concern here is his health and well-being, and, you know, take as much time as you possibly can and possibly need to as he works his way back. From a strictly procedural note, it also resets the timeline on his 30-day rehab assignment. So once he's good to go, he gets a fresh 30 days before the Jays have to activate him and to ramp up his work. So, you know, obviously the primary concern here is his well-being. You also think further down the line now about when Chad Green may rejoin, or join rather, because he hasn't been in this bullpen yet, may join this bullpen because, yeah, he's gonna need some time here. I mentioned it a little earlier as well, our friend Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic passing along that Hyunjin Ryu, he's listed as the starter for Sunday. So that comebacker off the knee, damage avoided. We have a lineup for today. It's Alek Manoah starting. This is the team that will try to score more than one run for Alek Manoah. Whit Merrifield leads off, plays in left. Brandon Belt gets the two spot today and plays first. Vlad has a DH day, hitting third. George Springer in the cleanup spot. Matt Chapman, Danny Jansen behind the plate for Alek Manoah. Davis Schneider hits seventh and plays second. And because Dalton Varsho is getting an off day, Nathan Lucas starts in center field. He will be the first Blue Jay other than Kiermaier or Varsho to man center field this year. He hits eighth. Santiago Espinal rounds it out at shortstop, hitting ninth, giving Paul DeJong a day off. Paul DeJong is going through it a little bit on the hitting side right now. A couple of opportunities to pinch hit for him last night. The Jays opted not to do that. I would imagine if John Schneider was asked about it, or had he been asked about it, that the answer would have been, well, we were up by a run and we didn't want to downgrade defensively to get, you know, a slightly better chance of starting something with nobody on base and things like that. You have Santiago Espinal. I know he hasn't had quite the defensive season. I probably would have pinch hit for DeJong somewhere in there. Maybe you bait a lefty out of the bullpen then if you have Varsho and Belt back to back, but you play that out and see where it goes. On the Cleveland Guardians side, this is a team that skews lefty heavy all the time. Against Alek Manoah, you are, of course, really, really incentivized to go lefty heavy. Manoah managed that pretty well against Boston, but we'll see how he does against the Guardians. Brian Rocchio will lead off. He is a switch hitter, so a lefty right off the top. Andres Jimenez is a lefty. He'll hit second. Jose Ramirez batting third. He obviously hits better from the left side as well. Cole Calhoun, another lefty, hitting cleanup. Ramon Laureano, the first righty Alek Manoah face, hitting fifth. Will Brennan, Another lefty, sixth. Bo Naylor, the Canadian catcher, lefty, hitting seventh. Miles Straw, a righty, manning center field down toward the bottom of the order. One of the longest home run-less streaks in all of baseball right now. And then Jose Tena rounds it out at short. So seven lefties are switch hitters that Alek Manoah will face today. The Jays opting to go the opposite way with only two lefties in there against Noah Syndergaard, getting Varsho a down day and Kevin Biggio not drawing in. Noah Syndergaard is pretty split neutral this year because, hey, here's the secret about platoon splits. The worse you are, the more likely it is that both sided hitters are hitting well against you. And Noah Syndergaard has not been particularly good this year, coming in with a 6.75 ERA, component metrics that more or less back that up. It's true that he doesn't walk anybody, but he's also a little prone to the long ball. And when I say he gets swing and miss far less often than he used to get swing and miss, I cannot exaggerate the degree to which that's true enough. He has an 8.2% swinging strike rate this year. At his peak, that was 14.2% back when he was a 260 ERA stud for the Mets. So big drop off for Noah Syndergaard. Big drop off in, you know, just the quality of the stuff in general. He's started to become more of a tinkerer. He throws seven different pitches now. He's going to lead with that 92-93 sinker, but he throws the changeup even more than the sinker if he's facing lefties. So if you're Belt or you're Nathan Lucas, get ready for that changeup. Against righties, though, he'll go sinker, changeup, cutter, curveball, straight four-seam fastball, and then the slider. He's got a split finger in the mix, too, that he's only thrown to lefties so far. It's also possible that with only four of those thrown, it's just a misclassification on the part of StatCast. But either way, six different pitches there if you're a righty. None of them particularly effective this year. The swing and miss rate isn't very high on any of them. The changeup, probably his best swing and miss pitch by whiff rate. But he's also allowing over a .300 batting average on it when guys do put it in play. So not a lot there for Noah Syndergaard to work with. That hasn't mattered for the Blue Jays at times, but if you're looking at pure pitcher quality, as weird as it is to say, this is 2023 and Noah Syndergaard is not the level of pitcher of the three guys that the Blue Jays just saw from the Guardians. Does that make you confident the Jays will score today? Probably not. On the other side, Alek Manoah coming off what was surely his most encouraging start in some time. Yes, he gave up three earned, including a pair of home runs against the Red Sox, but he got 6 2/3 in, struck out five batters, looked confident. If you're talking about those kind of intangible elements we look for from Alek Manoah, that looked the most like Alek Manoah we've seen in some time, even if the actual results were maybe a little better against the Angels, thanks to the work the bullpen did bailing him out. Maybe they were a little better against Detroit in his first start back. Quality competition a factor there. So we'll see if Alek Manoah can take a step forward again today. When I mentioned that there are seven lefties or switch hitters in for the Guardians, notable that similar to what we said with Syndergaard, Manoah has been bad enough that the platoon splits aren't extreme this year, and that's because he's been bad against both sides, but lefties still certainly hit him for a little bit more power. And then if you go back to last year and the year prior when Manoah was really good, then it was a case of, well, he's elite against righties and he's solid against lefties. So that is something to keep an eye out for in this one as well. The series this weekend against the Chicago Cubs, just I mentioned it earlier off the cuff, but a correction on what we talked about yesterday. It won't be Drew Smyly for Jose Bautista level of excellence today anymore for the Cubs. The Cubs have decided to move Drew Smyly to the bullpen. Javier Assad will start Friday, which bumps Justin Steele to Saturday, Jameson Tai on Sunday. The Jays will go Berríos, Bassett, and assuming no setback between now and then, Hyunjin Ryu on Sunday. The Jays would then start a stretch of 8 days where they have three off days. That is unheard of in general for the Blue Jays this year, but also coming off of 17-17. So if you're looking at something like today or any games on the weekend, how do you manage the bullpen? Whose workload is where? It is paramount to keep in mind that they have a bunch of off days coming up. They'll be off Monday. They'll be off next Thursday. They'll be off the following Monday. That doesn't mean you want to be reckless with guys, but there is some opportunity for rest ahead. Now, the biggest question that flows from that is, well, you have three off days in 8 days and only five games in that stretch. What are you going to do with a six-man rotation? Because even if you kept everyone on turn, that would mean, you know, if Hyunjin Ryu stays in the nominal sixth spot, that would mean he has 8 days off in between starts. Maybe they don't want to do that. Maybe they do. As Dan Schulman says, these things have a way of working themselves out. We just hope in this case it's a positive one instead of something like a comebacker. So that's the very near future, as in 1 p.m. The much deeper future is going to involve some guys who are playing down in the Florida Complex League, who are playing in low single A at Dunedin, who are on Baseball America's updated top 30 Toronto Blue Jays prospect list, which came out yesterday. Jeff Ponce of Baseball America has been down at the Blue Jays complex in Dunedin for a good chunk of the last week. After the break here, he's going to join us. We're going to pivot off of this Guardian series for the time being. We're going to talk to Jeff Ponce about everything he was seeing down at the Blue Jays complex and you know, try to get a feel for, hey, the deadline is passed, a couple guys are outbound, the draft is passed, a couple guys slot into the top 10 prospect rankings now. Just how strong is the Blue Jays system? Just how weak is the Blue Jays system? And those guys who are far, far away, who should we be excited about? Jeff Ponce of Baseball America joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Toronto Blue Jays Complex League team down in Florida threw a combined no-hitter on Monday. Pretty cool. And when you hear minor league combined no-hitter, maybe you think it was like four, five, six different pitchers contributing. No, Fernando Perez got seven of those hitless innings himself. He cracked Baseball America's hot sheet this week for some of the standout players around the minor leagues. Someone who has been down around that Dunedin team, around the Toronto Blue Jays complex in Dunedin for quite a bit the last week or so, is Jeff Ponce of Baseball America. He joins us now. Jeff, how are you?
Doing great, Blake. Excited to be on. How are you?
I'm good, man. So before we get into some of the Blue Jays specific players, I'm curious from just like a career standpoint and a workflow standpoint, what is it like when you pick out a team and you're going to go spend a couple days around that team, around their complex, whether it's the complex league team or the single A team? How does this all work kind of, mechanically in terms of what you're doing and how teams open up the doors for people like you?
Sure. Yeah. So I have four teams that I cover year round, meaning that I do all of the system updates and coverage in season, but also do it for our annual handbook that we put out around Christmas time every year. And that's 900 scouting reports. That's all 30 teams, top 30s. And we compile that over the off season. Of course, you know, a lot of that is based on our notes and information from the in-season work that we do. So whether I'm going here or going to a series, it's just sort of a normal thing. You reach out to the media folks with each club. You go out there and just sort of pick out a pref list of like who you're going to go after, who you want to watch, who you want to ask and, discuss with scouts and front office folks that, might be at these games. The complex is a little bit different. It's actually free and they're open to the public. So you can attend it, but, you reach out there and, I think the unique thing is you're seeing different teams almost for the same organization over the course of a week. There might be, sort of an A team or a B team, or a team one and team two to a degree because they are bigger rosters and players kind of move up and down. And you're seeing a lot of players that are debuting in the United States for the first time. Or, this time of year, you're seeing a lot of post-draft players, recent draftees that have just signed. And had the opportunity to see a few of those guys for the Blue Jays as well, including Arjun Namala.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about him and Sam Shaw and a couple other guys momentarily here. From a process standpoint, when you are talking about complex league guys, even low A guys, I know with you know, AAA and AA and at higher levels, it's you certainly don't want to just scout the stat line anyway. Obviously, if you're a fan, you can look at the stats, but, you know, worth remembering the International League has a league OPS over 800 and things like that. When it comes to these lowest levels, is it even more important to kind of sit the stats aside and really focus on the process side stuff that you can see up close?
Yeah, and I think the thing with complex, and especially if we are talking about recent draftees or players that maybe only have 15 to 20 games in the complex league, and there's a lot of those right now because, you know, the first wave of good players have already sort of been promoted to low A or even high A if they were, you know, some high-profile college draftees or something along those lines. So you're really working with incredibly small sample sizes of, you know, anywhere from 5 to maybe 40 at bats for a hitter. And, you know, pitcher, it could be anywhere from a couple of innings to maybe about 15 or 20. So I think when you're dealing with sizes and samples like that, you need to focus on skills. What sort of stuff is a hitter swinging at? Is he chasing out of the zone? Is he having trouble with pitches in a certain particular part of the zone that he does attack? You know, does he attack in the zone, or does he take a lot of meatballs, you know, down the middle of the plate that can show sort of being an overly passive player, which is something that's very common with young players that, you know, realize they can work a walk and, you know, sort of fake it a little bit like that. And then I think, you know, from the pitching side of things, it's even more straightforward. Are they throwing strikes? Are they not throwing strikes? Do they throw hard? You know, what's the pitch mix? What's the quality of stuff? Can they spin the breaking ball? Do they have an off-speed pitch? Sort of just those baseline things. Because at this point, I think you're really looking for players that can be considered legitimate prospects and players that are going to, you know, be worth following once they get to the full season level, whether that be next year.
All right, so let's kick some names around who you did see. And I know there are a couple guys in the higher levels of the minors, or in the case of Davis Schneider, someone who has now cracked the major leagues, who you've been tracking for a while. We'll circle back to some of those. But a couple guys that you got to see the last little bit. I'll start with Fernando Perez, just because, as I mentioned, he made the Baseball America hot sheet this week. He threw 7 hitless innings on Monday. He's a guy I'd been asked about a little earlier in the year as well, because even though it's only 9 starts, you know, pretty standout strikeout to walk numbers over a handful of starts here. Just 19 still. What do you like about Fernando Perez? What can you tell us about where he's at?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Fernando Perez he hasn't quite cracked the Blue Jays top 30 yet. I think that could potentially happen this offseason. You know, I didn't get, you know, eyes on him obviously until the list had already been turned in on Friday. But I think, you know, the thing with him is it's a starter's body. He's 6'3". He's listed at 170. He's probably more like 190. I still think there's room to sort of add strength. Only 19 years old. Really advanced strike thrower, actually from Nicaragua. And from what the organization's told me, it's from a really remote area of Nicaragua, kind of a farm boy. And he's really sort of had refined, we'll say, on the skill side of things. The stuff is okay. The fastball, sort of low 90s with decent shape. He's been up to 96, but I do think there's some folks in the organization, particularly on the player development side, that believe he can add velocity and sit more like 93 to 95 in the coming years. And there's feel for a breaking ball and a changeup. Like I said, he throws a lot of strikes, really knows how to pitch and compete. And sometimes, you know, that's a great place to be at 19 years old. As bodies mature, guys get stronger. They work with professional coaching as they move along at each level, and they're able to refine their pitch mix and do, you know, certain things. But the ability to throw strikes, sequence, that sort of stuff, sometimes a lot of it is innate and just a matter of the player's makeup and mindset.
So he'll be a name to watch, especially if those strikeout numbers, and hey, if you keep throwing 7 hitless innings, I don't care what level you're at or what age you're at, I'm going to be raising my eyebrows. So another name that has been, you know, this name's been a little more up and down, but again, with the good strikeout rates, the starter's body, Nolan Perry, a 12th round pick from last year. He didn't get into affiliated ball down the stretch last year. He's been working with that complex league team a little bit. I know he's someone who you had some thoughts on coming out of your visit.
Yeah, so he was a name that was added onto the Blue Jays top 30 list in not the most recent update, which actually went live on the site yesterday, but back in July, and you know, prior to the trade deadline, et cetera. And he was a guy where we were hearing a lot of great reports out of the complex from scouts, opposing scouts or with other organizations, you know, that I think have a really objective perspective on a lot of these players because they're writing up reports and, you know, making suggestions as for, you know, potential targets and trades, et cetera. And that's leading up to the trade deadline. Perry was a guy that had a lot of buzz, got some eyes on him actually last Friday against a really stacked FCL Yankees team. You know, there's several top 30 prospects on that team. Pitched the, you know, second leg of a doubleheader. Went five, struck out seven. Really good quality breaking ball. Solid fastball shape. Not a ton of velocity, but I heard the velocity was down from what it had been a little bit earlier in complex. But he's still someone who's sitting 91 to 93. You know, has been 2-4, touching 5 or 6. So there is some upside there. He's also still, you know, pretty young. This was a high school kid out of the New Mexico prep ranks. They took in the 12th round back in 2022. So he's, you know, falling right along, good pitcher's body, you know, 6'2", 195, sort of an average size build. But good strikes, definitely swing and miss stuff. And one of the better breaking balls, I'll say, I've seen in the lower minors in the Blue Jay system. And, you know, I watch these games religiously.
So that's, you know, a couple of teens on the pitcher side, a couple of teens on the hitter side who, hey, your timing was great. You get there and a couple of these high draft picks show up. You got to see the first little bit of Arjun Namala, Sam Shaw. I'm not sure if the games he got in were while you were there, but I know he's played a couple down there as well. When it comes to a teenager who just got drafted, Are you, like, what are you looking for? I'd imagine a big part of this is just, like, getting them used to affiliated ball and expanding kind of their 2023 workloads and things like that. But are there things you're right out of the gate looking for from guys like Namala and Shaw?
Yeah, I think when you look at players like this, you're really just looking at tools. What does this guy do well? Kind of the eye test in terms of what does he look like when he gets off the bus? You know, how big is he? How strong is he? How projectable is he? I think we can see a lot from body types. And I think, you know, the things that stick out about these guys stick out immediately. For Namala, it's bat speed. He's got incredibly, incredibly loud bat speed. It's really, really quick. The ball jumps off the bat. You know, I had been talking with a scout about him, and I had thrown out that he's not all that different from Orelvis Martinez, where I think there could be some swing and miss. I think the approach will be solid and will probably improve as he ages. And we certainly saw that with Orelvis this year. He took a huge step forward in terms of chasing out of the zone and the swing and miss stuff. And he just has really special quality of contact. Just really knows how to backspin the ball. You know, batted ball quality and contact quality was an immediate thing that stuck out for me. And I think at shortstop, you know, he's got a chance to stick there. You know, he's not the most refined defender at this point. Some of that can change. It was also only two games, and there's only so much that you can take away from two games. Guys will make mistakes, and, you know, then you could see him for five games, and, you know, they're playing completely clean games in the field too. So I think there's a lot of upside there. There's definitely power. I would expect that, you know, he's going to grow into more home run power as his body matures as well, because he's still fairly thin, but I think can get stronger. As for Shaw, he was a guy I wasn't familiar with. You know, obviously Namala was a huge name, you know, on the showcase circuit, just, you know, among preps and, you know, high school players, et cetera. Shaw was a little bit more underrated, you know, as a Canadian player out there in British Columbia. You know, Blue Jays do a great job, of course, of scouting their own backyard. They got him in the 9th round. Really advanced hit tool. Left-handed bat, makes a ton of contact, going to get on base a lot. I think this is, you know, I don't know how much power there is necessarily. He certainly could grow into more. Not the biggest guy. He's listed 5'10", 180, might be more like 5'9". But, you know, a really, really good talent and definitely somebody that I think just in terms of hit tool could probably grow quite a bit over the coming years. And the Blue Jays have done great with guys like that. If you look at some of these sort of after round 5 picks that they've had, Spencer Horowitz, Davis Schneider, even like Vinny Capra, guys that they've gotten the most out of. And Shaw has more upside than those guys. So I think he's an exciting prospect and a name to maybe follow over the next coming years in the system.
You heard it here first. Sam Shaw, more upside than greatest baseball player of all time, Davis Schneider, who's, you know, obviously changing our perspective on undersized second baseman here in Toronto. Oh, so those are some of the newer names, the teenage names. I know you got to look at the single A team as well. I think the prospect that most Blue Jays fans are probably still most curious about, given the stop and start nature of his season, is Ricky Tiedemann. He had the rehab outing on the weekend at Dunedin, his last one before rejoining New Hampshire later this week. I believe he threw three innings, only allowing one hit, struck out nine. That gives him 18 strikeouts over eight innings on this rehab stint. Did you get a good look at Tiedemann, and what were you hearing in kind of asking around about just kind of the weirdness of his season in general?
Yeah, so I've seen Tiedemann now five times because I'm up here about 40 minutes outside of Manchester, New Hampshire. So I'm at that park quite a bit. I was down there, doubled up that day, you know, did the doubleheader in the morning at the Dunedin complex, and then went home, showered, went back to Dunedin, and, you know, checked out Ricky Tiedemann. I've seen him now four or five times. That was the best I've ever seen him. He was electric, fastball sat 96 to 97. He touched 98 miles an hour. It was really crisp. I saw him his last couple starts before he went on the injured list, and you could tell, like, he wasn't turning over the changeup the way he typically turns over that changeup, which is an excellent pitch, might be his best pitch. The slider wasn't breaking, sort of catching the outside part of the plate when he was backdooring it to right-handed hitters, which is something he does incredibly well. He's really proficient with that. He was doing all that stuff again. And, I don't know if it's been announced yet. I'm assuming he's probably, I know New Hampshire doesn't have anybody listed starting on Friday. I would assume Tiedemann probably gets promoted. Maybe he gets one more start in Dunedin, but I would assume he's probably up here. So I'm guessing tomorrow night I might be watching Ricky Tiedemann again. But, you know, I think the thing is it was a biceps injury. He's been dealing with some injuries in terms of, you know, bicep, which is obviously sometimes connected to the elbow. He's had some shoulder stuff, I think, during spring training. When he's in a mound, he's electric. He's as good as anybody that's out there. It's just a matter of whether or not Tiedemann is healthy and can see the lineup two times. Because if we can get this guy up to 80-90 pitches per outing, he's going to be something special.
That's great to hear, and hopefully the workload continues there. I know some Blue Jays fans had been excited at the prospect of him having a full minor league season, maybe joining the Jays down the stretch in a bullpen capacity. I'd imagine they probably just want to make sure he gets his innings in at this point. Another name pitching for that Dunedin team, I'm not sure if the timing worked out exactly for you to see him, but did you get a chance to put eyes on Kendry Rojas?
I did. I saw Kendry Rojas the previous evening, Thursday night, there in Dunedin. Didn't have his best outing, but, you know, it's really easy, really, really unique, low left-handed arm slot. The Jays love their lefties. And good quality breaking ball, good changeup, and good fastball. And, you know, I think you can see the makings of a potential mid-rotation starter there with three pitches. He's somebody that consistently has gotten great feedback from scouts, opposing scouts, the entire season. He's really athletic, really projectable, left-handed. I think there is more in the tank in terms of velocity. The stuff could even tick up. It might be a slow burn where it takes, you know, another two or three years, maybe even four, for him to fully be where he's going to be. But I do think he's a potential rotation piece and one of the more exciting prospects in the system.
I had one name left on my list to ask you about guys you saw in Dunedin, and I forgot him when we were talking complex side. Gage Stanifer, 19th round pick last year. I know he's still just 19, but another guy with like a big body and maybe some potential to miss some bats there. I mentioned him just because I know you saw him throw five innings. You tweeted out some video that everyone should check out on your Twitter account as well for a little bit more on all of these guys. But I think you saw by far his best outing of the season. 19th round pick recently. Is he a guy that should be on the radar of Jays fans, or is he still pretty far away?
Yeah, I think he's still pretty far away, but maybe could be a breakout prospect next season. He definitely showed feel for, you know, three different pitches. He's got a nice splitter in the high 80s that I like quite a bit. Was landing the fastball, commanding it to both sides of the plate that day. He's got some ride on it, so that's going to play in the upper part of the zone. And, you know, the slider wasn't bad as well in the low 80s. Just hasn't pitched a whole ton. You know, he's out of, you know, Indiana. So, you know, in terms of his experience and the quality of competition that he's faced in his lifetime is pretty limited. So, you know, he's out here at FCL making his debut and has pitched pretty well. At least in my look, it was one of the better outings that I saw while I was down there for 6 or 7 days.
Well, that's encouraging. It sounds like it was a fruitful trip. Now you're back to the New Hampshire area. So you've gotten to look at some of these Fisher Cats guys, as you've mentioned as well. Wondering where you see one of the more recent promotions to the New Hampshire Fisher Cats, Alan Roden, another member of that 2022 draft class, a third round pick who has already made his way up to Double A. Now, I know he's a little older. He's 23 on closer to 24 than 23. So maybe it's expected that he hit at high A the way he hit, but he was hitting .321 with an OPS up over 900 before he got the promotion. How high are you on the hit tool for Alan Roden?
I'm really high. I think it's a plus hit tool. Advanced bat to ball skills. He gets on base, you know, so it's not just contact and he swings at everything. Because there are some hitters like that, but these guys just have such innate bat to ball skills. They can hit anything, anywhere. He takes his walks, doesn't chase, makes pitchers work, really grinds out at bats. I think, you know, he's exactly what people mean when they use the sort of old cliche, a professional hitter. There hasn't been a ton of power as of yet. The exit velocity numbers haven't been crazy. I think it's sort of sneaky underneath there. He's got a very level swing. He doesn't try to hit for power. It's a line drive sort of, you know, use the whole field sort of a swing. But it's been productive for him, and he's been good at each stop. He's a guy that I had eyes on with Wareham prior to the draft here in the Cape Cod League. And, you know, somebody that dealt with the 2020 season, I think we can't forget that kind of threw off the age numbers a little bit when you miss an entire season. And, you know, that affected a lot of guys that are in the minors or in college. So he's kind of an interesting one. I think he was a late bloomer. There's definitely a huge hit tool here. And he's, you know, I think he's probably an average, if not an above average corner outfielder. He's a pretty good out there. He's kind of a sneaky athlete. There might be more power projection there as well. He's somebody that going into that draft in 2022, a lot of analytical systems had sort of flagged him as a potential sleeper and an undervalued pick. And I think he kind of falls in line with a lot of these Jays guys because they do love their hit tool guys.
Alan Roden up to number 8 in the latest Baseball America, a midseason top 30 for the Blue Jays organization. David Schneider, if you're wondering, is up to 10 there. You can go over to Baseball America and check all of that out. Jeff, as you go through the exercise of updating the mid-30s here, or the midseason top 30s here, being down at the Complex League a little bit, I know you... The way it works is you primarily focus on a handful of teams, but you guys as Baseball America, as you sit down and you kick things around, where would you say the strength of the Blue Jays system, you know, how do they stack up? I know entering the year they were kind of low middle of the league. Is that still where they are? Have they ascended to maybe middle of the league in terms of system quality?
You know, we have to see. I think that the high end, adding the Mala, certainly has helped a tremendous amount, but they also traded away, you know, a handful of pretty good prospects, particularly like Reversi and, you know, Klofstein. Trading those guys away kind of hurts the depth a little bit. And they haven't had a ton of super high end guys, you know, outside of Ricky Tiedemann. Tucker Thoman hasn't really taken off, I think, the way people hoped, and some of those other picks like Doughty, et cetera. So I think it's probably bottom third at this point. But we'll see. We'll see how they rank out. I think it's probably going to be somewhere probably in that like 20 to 24 range, simply because they do have a couple of high-end players here. We have two top 100 guys in Ricky Tiedemann and Orlando Martinez. They have Namala. You know, and I think like Barriera, it's been a little bit tough with how his season's been. Barger hasn't necessarily grabbed the bull by the horns in terms of, you know, doing some of that stuff. But I do think that one thing the Blue Jays are really good at is I think their 10 to sort of 40 is a lot better than people realize. There's a lot of valuable pieces there. There's a lot of guys like Davis Schneider, et cetera, that fall into that group that are these underrated hit tool guys that they really do a good job of sort of developing more power and, you know, having them play all over the place and get some, you know, multi-position eligibility and experience so they can sort of fit in a utility role. They have a lot of relievers. I think Connor Cook is one of the best relief prospects in baseball. He's a name that I think a lot of folks don't realize. And then I think, you know, players like Hayden Younger and, you know, Yosver Zulueta are probably going to be pretty good bullpen pieces long-term. You, of course, have Hagen Danner as well, who has legitimate bullpen stuff. And they have some other guys in sort of the back end here, like a Devereaux Harrison or Mason Flaherty, who are also really good bullpen pieces, and some guys that are also top 30, like TJ Brock. So it's a group where they found a way to sort of develop and find a lot of underrated pieces in the later rounds. It's just a matter of those top round studs and signings. It's really panning out and turning into the kind of players that, you know, the Jays organization thought they were going to be when they brought them in.
That's a good thing to hear, even if the ranking maybe won't make Jays fans super happy when you guys get around to the end of season once. Connor Cook, a name, by the way, who is already on his third level this season. We're expecting him to make his Buffalo Bisons debut any day now. Jeff Ponce of Baseball America, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I really appreciate all the insight and all the great work over at BA.
Thanks a lot, man. Glad to be on.
Jeff Ponce of Baseball America. Again, you can go over to Baseball America and check out the Jays' latest updated midseason top 30. Make sure you check out Jeff's Twitter account as well. It's Jeff Ponce, B-A. Ponce is P-O-N-T-E-S. I've tweeted out his account as well, as I always do with the guests. You can get a little bit more detail on some of the players we talked about, more detail on some of the players we didn't talk about, as well as some scouting video from his time down in Dunedin. That is the Deep Future. Let's take a break and kick it to the not-so-distant past. Jose Bautista Level of Excellence Day is Saturday down at Rogers Center. A name who will be there for it, I believe he's already in town or on his way into town, is one of Jose Bautista's managers when he was a Toronto Blue Jay twice. John Gibbons joins Jays Talk Plus next as we continue on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays Guardians wrap up this series at 1 p.m. Sho Ali and Ben Shulman will have Jays Talk for you 12 to 1. And then again, post-game, Blair and Barker in their usual 5 to 7 slot. A couple quick updates. Jordan Romano threw a 33-pitch bullpen session in Toronto yesterday. He can be as activated as early as Saturday. Team still deciding if he'll need a rehab assignment or not. Bo Bichette has been doing some cage hitting and jogging, but not running full or doing the bases just yet. No timeline until he progresses to the bases. This comes from John Schneider via our pal Keegan Matheson over at BlueJays.com. So that game's at 1 o'clock. Before we get to that, though, we got to look ahead to Saturday. It is Jose Bautista going into the Level of Excellence down at Rogers Center, a man who knows Jose Bautista very well. So well, in fact, that he had him on his podcast this week. Joining us now is the former manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, host of the Gibby Show, author of Gibby, Tales of a Baseball Lifer. It's John Gibbons. John, how are you, man? Good morning.
Hey, good morning, man. Thank you. Thanks for the nice introduction. Yeah, hey, I actually owe Jose a lot, man. He kept me here. He allowed me to stick around a few more years. You want to know the truth?
Yeah, I mean, hey, you. Well, let's pivot to Jose in just a second here. I wanted to ask you, though. So last time I talked to you for this show, it was last year, and your book, Gibby, Tales of a Baseball Lifer, wasn't quite out yet. It was just about to come out. Now it's out. Now you've even got an audiobook version out that's available for people. What's it been like to have that out and see the reception to that book and now people listening to you as they drift off to sleep at night?
Yeah. Hey, let's put it this way, man. You know, it wasn't like I gotta write a book, man. I'm just obsessed with writing. But no, but it came out. You know, there's been a pretty good response to it. Really has, and people have been, you know, they've been good to me. And then of course the audio book came out like a few days ago, and I ended up reading that thing. But you know, it's been really kind of cool. You know, it allowed me to reconnect with some of my old friends and some old fans out there, and most of them seemed to like it. I thought they might like it. But, it's just one of those deals, man. Just keep on rolling, you know. I don't worry too much about it.
It's great. I enjoyed the book. I hope people check out the audio book as well. You've also got The Gibby Show, your podcast that's up wherever people get their podcasts or on YouTube. Man, you've had just about everyone on there, including John Schneider, Don Mattingly, a bunch of the current players. Do you have a favorite guest or an interview now that you're one of us as an official media host?
Well, I don't know if you call me official yet, man, because I tell you what, I appreciate your guys' jobs a little bit better now. You know, it's not because I can mangle the English language with the best of them, you know, and it's not as easy as everybody thinks, is it? So, but you know what? There's been so many good guys that come on there, really. I'm not sure who my favorite is, but, you know, naturally Jose Donaldson starting it off, Mark Burley, you know, and they've all been good to me. Mattingly was a really good one tonight. And Buck Martinez, you know, I go way back with Buck. So it's really hard to say. You know, they've all been good. And they've all been we appreciate them coming on, you know. I found out what you guys probably found out is sometimes it's tough to get guys to come on there. You know, they got things going on and they, you know, they get tugged every which way and sometimes they get sick of it. But we've been pretty fortunate with that.
Yeah, it's a challenge, but it's part of the job. I got Jeff Azzopardi behind the glass to bug people for me so I don't have to do it myself.
That's the key.
And hey, we know Jose until very recently didn't love doing the media stuff either. Now he's doing it as part of this week. And you know, I know he did some stuff during the pandemic, the watch backs of the bat flip game and stuff like that. How was having Jose on the show? You guys just kind of reminiscing in podcast form instead of just catching up over a pint or whatever.
Yeah. You know, it was, you know, we definitely put him on, you know, because his show was coming up and it was our chance to honor him a little bit. But, you know, I spent so many years with those guys in Jose, and it's, you know, we went through a lot of ups and downs. We went and, you know, we finally hit the pinnacle there a couple of years after a long drought, you know, up there in Toronto. And then, of course, he parted ways with the organization. And so it was good just to see him and hear him and you know, invited me up for this ceremony. And but it's always good, you know, it's always fun to sit around BS and throw, you know, reminisce about some things like that. And, you know, he's, you know, Jose's always involved. I mean, he's a very busy guy and everything. I mean, even back then when he was a player, you know, and so it's tough to pin him down sometimes. And so we felt pretty good that he came on the show. And, you know, he's definitely earned this, and it's going to be great to see his name go up on the level of excellence. You know, I guarantee he's going to get some kind of reception. And I hope he brings a bat along and flips it again.
Yeah, I was saying that, you know, if they give him a live microphone or something like that, maybe he flips the mic. But a commemorative bat would be just as good. And for any fans going down, the first 20,000 fans at Rogers Center get a bat flip bobblehead. So anyone going down can keep an eye out for that. John, you getting to talk to Jose a little bit on the show and just knowing him, obviously this means a ton to the fan base and to the franchise to get to honor Jose. How much does this mean to him personally?
Oh, it's huge. You know, it's just a culmination of a great career. You know, and he didn't have an easy career. I mean, it didn't start out the way he wanted it to, and he really didn't. You know, teams gave he was basically labeled a utility player, and they bounced him around the field, and he really never got his true shot. And he was going from team to team. You know, that one year he was a Rule 5 guy. It wasn't until Toronto that they gave him that opportunity. You know, and even that didn't start out, you know, as an everyday guy. You know, he ran into Cito and those guys, and Cito's done wonders for so many players. But that's where it all came together for him, you know. So that's who he is. He's a Blue Jay, you know. And he had some tremendous years. And, you know, even through when the team wasn't very good, you know, the team wasn't winning, he still was one of the top players in the game. And then, of course, when things came together a little bit, you know, he got to show off a little showcase. You know, of course, naturally the bat flip. But then even when we got – in that game six against Kansas City, he had two home runs and tried to single-handedly win it for us, you know, and there's something special about this guy. He's different. He can be a different cat He's emotional. He's volatile. But he's an incredible competitor, and he loves the limelight, man. He loves to shine and he loves the opportunity to perform when the game's on the line, you know. And they all can't say that.
Man, it's an extra special thing. Obviously, you got to get there, but the guys who turn it up in those big moments are always a blast. So, John, when the Jays first acquired Jose, you missed them by a little bit in 2008. So you come back in 2013. He's had these big monster seasons behind him. Do you remember what your initial impressions were? I know that 2013 season didn't quite go the way you guys wanted. It wasn't until 2014, 2015 that things started turning the right way. But what were your initial impressions of Jose and the impact that, you know, his breakout and his level of star had on a room?
Well, you know, I'd heard about him. I'd watched enough highlights, you know, when I wasn't around, and I also heard, hey, he's a handful now. You come back here to Toronto, and I said, good. That's the way I love it, man. We need more star players, you know, that test you, that kind of thing. So, you know, but he's really a good human being. You know, he does a lot of things off the field for people that people don't realize. You know, he contributes to charities, and it's a lot of behind the scenes stuff. So he cares about that stuff. You know. And you don't always find that, but he's always gracious with his time. But you know what? He rose to, you know, his best in Toronto, and thank God we got in the playoffs where we got the chance to show it, you know, in front of the world, you know. And that's where, you know, the bat flip naturally put him on the map as far as, wow, you know, he'd had some great years. But when your team's not winning, you kind of get lost out there. But when he did that, when he flipped that bat and hit that big home run to win it for us, yeah, that's when I think he got his true recognition. Now, everybody didn't like it, but that didn't matter. That's when he first got his true recognition that he deserved.
Do you remember, John, what the reaction was like internally? Like, obviously, the moment is so huge. The bat flip home run is so important. But then when you guys saw the, like, negative reaction to it from some of the, a nice way to phrase the people who didn't enjoy the bat flip. But what did you guys think in that room? Just kind of have a laugh at people not liking it or what?
You know, we didn't even think too much about it. It's been 22, 23 years of frustration for a country, you know, and so that home run kind of set us free, set us everybody free, right? And the thing is, the Texas Rangers, they celebrated home runs more than anybody. That was kind of ironic about it. But it was such, I put it this way, if I was on the other side, it wouldn't have bothered me one bit, you know, because I would have understood the motion of it. You know, we went down 0-2, came back and won 2 down in Texas on the road. And then fell behind this game late, you know, in the winner take all game. So there was so much, you know, emotion. It would have been disappointing for either team because we were both very good to bow out in that round, right? So there was just emotions were flowing. They were frustrated. And like I said, though, you know, Jose, a lot of guys in the league didn't care for him because he beat him all the time, you know, and he was an emotional guy, and you knew he was around, you know, and they didn't all like that, right? And most of them couldn't get him out. And then when he hits that big home run like that, and then you really know he's around when he flips that thing. But you know, it was so much joy, fun, and happiness. You know, just advancing and winning that game. You know, we knew it was out there, but it never really, you know, that didn't affect as much. But we also knew that the following year something was probably going to happen, you know?
Yeah, it certainly did. So, John, when you talk about, you said you'd been warned a little bit, Jose could be a bit of a handful in the room. And then obviously there is that level of competitor to him. I wonder how that impacted the rest of the room, not only from that perspective, but also everything we hear is that Jose was also legendary in terms of the work and preparation he put in and things like that. Even if a guy isn't the typical, you know, raw leader in the room, how big an influence does a personality and a work ethic like Jose's have to a group?
Well, you know what? See, I like his style of leading better than anything. You know, you don't have to be raw and vocal and everything like that. But I tell you what, nobody worked harder, and I tell people this all the time. You know, I managed some great players, right, and so many over the years. And he came up ready to play and showed up to play more than anybody I've ever had, you know. And that's not knocking anybody else. But Jose understood, you know, when he didn't get you know, when he was a utility guy early on, you know, he had that chip on his shoulder, I think. And so he was going to maximize his career. That would, you know, he understood that, you know, people came to watch him play, right? Which is very important to the big leagues. That's a big part of it. And his team needed him, and he was pushing himself to win. You know, that he was starved for that himself. You know, like everybody else. But he showed up. He wouldn't take a day off. You couldn't get him to take a day off, even if he needed one, because he understood that was his responsibility. He was going to maximize every day he had in the big leagues. And a special guy. You know, he really is. You know, he's one of those guys that, leave him alone, get out of the way. He's going to do everything right. He's going to piss you off every now and then. Just like I piss him off. He's going to piss somebody off because, you know what, he's got that edge about him, which is big in athletics, professional athletics. You know, that's what the champions have, you know. Let him do his thing. And you know what, at the end of the night, we're probably going to be in pretty good shape.
So, John, you'll be down here Saturday. You'll get a look at the current Blue Jays team. That's 14 games over 500, fighting for a playoff spot here, looking to head to the wild card and repeat some of that 2015-2016 magic. I know you didn't have many of these guys. I think Jansen and Meza might have been the only guys you had your last go-around with this team. But what are your impressions of this group this year, and when you have gotten a chance to check them out, where they're at?
Yeah, I really like the team. You know, I think they have the best pitching in the game right now, top to bottom, with the rotation in the bullpen. You know, in Kikuchi stepping up, right? Berrios bouncing back like that. Those were, you know, everybody was kind of wondering how they would bounce back this year. And they've been tremendous. You got to tip your hat to those guys. And of course, you know, you got the other guys, you know, at the top. You know that Bassett and those guys. And hey, Manoah looks like the old guy. He's starting to bounce back, which is very, very big, right? And of course, they got Rue back too. And now, in the additions to the bullpen, you know, Cabrera's, you know, he's struggled there in St. Louis, but he's pitching really well for them. The key is, though, you got to get Romano back. Mm-hmm. He'll be back, but they have a deep bullpen. They really do. And you know what, they got good, they got a solid, very solid team on the field that can burn you, you know. And I know people complaining about the offense here, You know, they're solid. They're sitting in a great spot right now, right? You know, they keep playing good ball. You know, Tampa's faltering a little bit, and their injury bugs got them. You know, Houston's taking it to Baltimore the last couple of nights. Those are all the teams that are in their bunch together. This could all flip, and the Blue Jays could end up on top. You never know. There's plenty of games left, you know. But the key is just getting in, and they're going to get in because they're too good. And with the pitching they have and the bullpen they have, they could go all the way. There's no doubt. That was my prediction at the beginning of the year, was Toronto was going to play Atlanta in the World Series anyway. I mean, you know, that was a little biased, both those teams. But no, in reality, if you look at it, that could very well happen because they're both very, very good.
Yeah, our pal Alex Anthopoulos over in Atlanta would be thrilled with that outcome as well. I think they're looking pretty good over there. John, so I know, you know, 2015, you guys went on this huge run around this time of year, right? Around the trade deadline, you were just 500. Sometimes, right. You know, I've heard some players or managers say, you know, mid-August is maybe the toughest time to manage through day-to-day because it is the dog days and the playoffs are close, but not too close. How important is it, you know, in the manager's chair to have something like, you know, in 2015 you guys had to fight back to make the playoffs. This team has the chance to maybe fight back and, as an underdog, chase the division. How helpful is a goal like that, or is it just about, you know, kind of focusing on the day-to-day, even if it does feel like a grind this time of year?
Yeah, it's definitely a grind, but you know, when you're a good team and you're in a position to get to the postseason, you know, it gives you that little extra, you know, that little extra energy that you don't always have, you know. And what's so different about the game nowadays is you look up there in the Yankees and the Red Sox on the bottom part of the standings, right? And it used to not be that. It used to be that they would run away by in June, and everybody else, you know, was out of it by then. But then they started adding wild card teams, and it's been done wonders for the game. You know, it keeps everybody involved. It gives most teams a chance, you know. But you know, with us in 15. I mean, we were the top offense in the game, but we played. Our defense wasn't very good. You know, we had a couple of guys. Reyes was struggling short, and playing infielders in the outfield. And the key was us was shoring up our defense. You know, of course, they had David Price, another starter. And then otherwise, we're 500. That just shows you got to play defense if you're going to win championships, right? But then, it was like a light switch, right? But it was like, wow, you know, the GM and the front office going to go all out and do this. You know, let's go, boys. You know, we're the year – you know, it's funny, the year before that, we were almost in an identical spot. We didn't do anything because there was no money to do anything. And, you know, you remember Jansen and Batista, they did interviews down in Houston, you know, to say, hey, you know, we expect to do something. We didn't. And so we just kind of fizzled, right? But it does give you a shot of adrenaline when, you know what, hey, everybody's serious about this. And, you know, with a couple of nice moves, you know, that it gives you that. You go, okay, hey, everybody's in here. You know, everybody's all in. So, and that does wonders. And, you know, they got enough young guys, too, that, you know, the dog days doesn't hurt them as bad. You know, we had some older guys. You feel it more. But you're not going to – even a side note, there's no better weather during the summer than up there in Toronto. And so it's always nice playing there, you know. It's not like you're going down in Atlanta and some of those with Texas and, man, you're just dying out there on the field because it's so doggone hot, you know.
Well, let's hope it's a sunny one on Saturday. I think there's a bit of rain in the forecast for Saturday, but hopefully that plays out in our favor as Jose Bautista is placed in the level of excellence down at Rogers Center. John Gibbons, you'll be there for anyone who wants a little bit more of Gibby and Bautista. Bautista was a guest on the Gibby Show this week, wherever you get your podcasts or YouTube. John Gibbons, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it.
You betcha, man. Thanks for having me.
John Gibbons, host of The Gibby Show, author of Gibby, Tales of a Baseball Lifer. He'll be down at Rogers Center on Saturday. Ricky Romero and Travis Snyder will be down there. Edwin Encarnacion will be down there. I'd imagine 40,000 plus of you will be down there as well. 20,000 of you will receive a Jose Bautista bat flip bobblehead. Jay's shop at Rogers Center is also going to have exclusive specialty merch, a couple authentic items around Jose Bautista. As a reminder, it is a 3:07 game, but you're going to want to get down there nice and early for the pregame ceremony. We will, on the TV side, have a special edition of Blue Jays Central at 2:30 on Saturday. We'll continue to tee that up tomorrow as well. Right now, we turn the page to today's game. The Jays have taken 2 of 3 against the Cleveland Guardians so far with a whole big scoring total of 4-2, a couple of 1-0 games traded back and forth after the Jays won the opener 3-1. Today, it's Alek Manoah and Noah Syndergaard. If you were looking on paper at the starters in this series, you would not expect to continue the run of pitchers' duels. These would be the two. Noah Syndergaard struggling this year with the ERA up over 6, not missing a lot of bats, a lot of peripheral stuff that suggests he just might not have it anymore. But this Toronto Blue Jays team hasn't always hit that type of guy. Alek Manoah on the other side, coming off of one of the more encouraging starts he's had in terms of getting lefties out, giving the Blue Jays some length, some of the intangible competitor stuff you look for in an Alek Manoah outing. He'll face a Cleveland Guardians lineup that has 7 guys hitting from the left side today when you include the switch hitters that'll hit from that side. So a good challenge for him there. Show Ali and Ben Shulman will take you through the lineups and give you a whole lot more from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. here as they set you up with the Jays pregame show. They'll also have Jays talk for you postgame, and then Blair and Barker will tag in at 5 o'clock. They'll do 5 to 7 in their normal spot. That's the nice thing about their time slot with a 1 p.m. game. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to tee up the Cubs series, continue to talk about Jose Bautista. If you missed it a little earlier, the updates from down at Progressive Field via Arden Zwelling and Keegan Matheson are that Hyunjin Ryu is going to throw a side session in Toronto on Friday, and assuming everything goes well, he will start on Sunday against the Cubs. Jordan Romano threw a 33-pitch bullpen session back in Toronto yesterday. Felt good. Still deciding whether they're going to send him on a rehab assignment or not, but he is eligible to come off the IL on Saturday. The latest on Bo Bichette, that he is jogging and taking swings, but he'll need to dial up the intensity and run the bases before we get a firm timeline on this. Arden Zwelling saying it's very unlikely that Bichette is back this weekend against the Cubs. The Jays also have that stretch with 3 off days in 8 days where maybe they decide to be, hey, extra cautious. If you don't bring Bobichet back until, say, the Reds series, well, then he gets an extra 4 days and you only miss him for 2 games. We'll see how they manage that. We'll see how they manage the 6-man rotation through all of that as well. And the bullpen will get a little extra rest. Before we get to there, though, they have to get through this Cubs series. They have to finish taking care of the Cleveland Guardians today. Manoa against Syndergaard. It is Merrifield atop the lineup. Brandon Belt getting the shot in the 2-hole. Vlad, Springer, Chapman, Danny Jansen catches today, hit 6. Davis Schneider back in there, second base, hitting 7th. Nathan Lucas will become the first non-Varsho, non-Kiermaier guy to play in center field for the Blue Jays this year. He hits 8th. Santiago Espinal gives Paul DeJong an off day. Thanks to John Gibbons for coming on. Always a lot of fun to talk to Givi. To Jeff Ponce of Baseball America for giving us the lowdown from the Jays complex and low A team in Dunedin. To Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score for coming on and doing some Jose Bautista trivia. Thank you and welcome back to Jeff Azzopardi, who's back behind the glass today. Lance Kennedy, Jennifer Rolnick. Again, Sho Ali and Ben Shulman coming up next. I can see them back there. They're having a laugh. Ben Wagner and Chris LaRue on the call for you. Jays, Guardians, 1 p.m. Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360.